Life of the Mind podcast. I'm Sherry Walsh. I'm assistant head of Brookwood. I'm here with podcast regular David Bowes, who's head of the theology department at Brookwood. Hi, David.
Hey, Sherry.
And I'm also here with Andrea Francois, who is the K-6 director. Hi, Andrea.
Hello, Sherry.
We are here today to talk about Andrea McKean's Brief Loves That Live Forever. It's listed on the front as a novel. It is in distinct and in some ways discrete chapters, and we can talk about that. This will give us a chance to talk about the chapters separately and then also to talk about the work as a whole. Andrea McKean is a contemporary novelist. Andrea is ready with the bio.
According to his very short bio at the end of his rather short book, he was born in Siberia in 1957 and has lived in France since 1987.
Excellent. And we know about Andrea McKean for a variety of reasons. I had read Dreams of My Russian Summers, his earlier novel, and David introduced me, maybe us, to McKean through Eric Varden. And I think that's how David encountered Andrea McKean. Do you want to talk a little bit about the connection?
Yeah, so those who are regular podcast listeners have heard this on our Varden podcast, but Eric Varden mentions Andrea McKean in his last chapter of On Christian Remembrance, The Shattering of Loneliness, On Christian Remembrance, where he mentions McKean as someone who, I believe he refers to him as like a blind prophet, one who has kind of experienced the infinite breaking through the finite, but does not know exactly, I would say, who that is doing the breaking through. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think, you know, he has something to show us and help us kind of see more clearly.
And experience from different angles, mm-hmm. right? Some of what Varden gets at, right? So thinking about McKean as, again, one of those writers who has a kind of longing for something beyond. McKean is a secular writer and asks a lot of questions, answers a lot of them, actually. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't answer sort of ultimate theological questions, I don't think. Andrea's making a face. What does it mean?
Oh, no, I would agree with you on that. And I wonder if maybe he's okay with that.
Yeah.
But maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think so he does have some questions that he answers, and we can talk about the themes that we've encountered in this book. The form of the book is 8 chapters. The whole book comes in at 134 pages. I don't have my glasses on. 134 pages. And to get there, you've got these 8 discrete chapters. The style of the writing I would characterize as very accessible, very concrete, almost fairy tale like in ways, and in places kind of magical and luminous, and in places more kind of concrete and I was going to say gritty, but gritty seems like too much, but more concrete. So, I think those are some thoughts I have initially about the style. And as we were starting the podcast, we were talking about our favorite chapters. And I noticed that the two that I am especially drawn to are the second chapter and the penultimate chapter. And David noticed some chapters in the middle that he especially likes. And we started thinking a little bit about the way that the chapters speak to each other and how themes are opened up. And there are some things, again, that are resolved, but not everything. There's a good bit of openness in the text as well. Do we want to start there and see if it takes us then to somewhere more specific? Is there a theme that we see opened in one place and picked up again in another place, or something else structural that we want to point to?
Well, I think if we wanted to kind of see, like, start with the first chapter, where I think he lays out kind of a little bit about what he's doing, or at least what I'm interpreting as what he's doing, which kind of gives us, I think, a helpful lens through which to read the book and see how he gets things right, but also how, like, what he's lacking. So the first chapter is called The Tiny Minority, and we're introduced to this figure, Dmitri Ress, who started life as a political dissident in Soviet Russia, but eventually does not get cynical. Sometimes he feels cynical, but realizes that there's something deeper to reality than just kind of going through the motions or just being a politician. Like, there has to be something deeper besides politics, which ties into our last the last time the three of us were together.
That is true.
But so he's and it's funny because,
and that's a reference to the Yasha Monk.
Yes. Because it's funny because, like, all of his posters attacking the regime, he's never, like, putting up another political answer. And the reason why he gives his insight after he catches a glimpse of this woman. And he says, this is on page 13. So he breaks down into kind of, there's three categories of people. Everyone kind of falls into these three categories. The conciliators, or the sleepwalkers, people who just go through the motions. They're not really living. They're just kind of wherever they are. That's just the status quo, and they're just going through life. The cynics, who know it's all a lie, but just go with it for money, prestige, power, influence. And then the rebels are the ones who recognize the lie of the elite, of the regime, and want to change it, but are, like, very politically motivated and seeing things through, like, a politics-only lens. But then he has...
Then he introduces a fourth category.
He introduces this fourth category. And so he says he says, there are also those who have the wisdom to pause in an alleyway like this and watch the snow falling.
Yeah. And the reaching to nature here and elsewhere seems to be, I mean, that seems to be a motif. That there are ways out of the oppressive political situation. Some of those ways have to do with personal relationships. Some of those ways have to do with interactions with nature.
Yeah, but it's all of them have this kind of common thing where it's, you're able to see more clearly about what reality is.
Yeah.
And it's able to penetrate to something that, like you said, actually enables relationship. Because the conciliators, the cynics, and the rebels, there's no actual relationship in those three categories. But with the people who are able to slow down, to notice, to see the beauty, and to kind of walk in that awareness, actually makes the love possible.
Yeah, good. So that sets up the brief loves, right?
Yeah.
So talking about, again, things that cut through politics, that cut through ideology, when you have such an apparent aggressive ideological focus all the time in the environment of the stories, then you have these other elements that can cut through. Anything you want to add, Andrea, about the first chapter?
No, I don't think so. I think David has summed it up very well. It is an interesting way to be dropped into a story with an unnamed narrator who is never named.
Yeah.
And it is an interesting tension you just have to live with throughout the whole book, is that we are being shown these, like, brief glimpses of illumination of relationship with a person that we don't know his name.
Right.
And in often cases, he doesn't name the person he experiences these things with. Mm. In some cases, because he doesn't know them.
Right. Mm. And in some cases, delayed, too. Like, he'll name them, but you don't find out until later. You wonder if it might be some of the same people, and then it is or it isn't.
It is or it isn't, and it's exciting when it is, and it's confusing when it's not. But it is a really odd... It's an odd experience as a reader to show up in a story in the middle of a walk between two people who also don't know each other very well.
Right.
So we have to just do that throughout the whole book.
Mm-hmm.
And,
So
it makes the overt politics of it seem so important
mm-hmm.
because it is the most concrete thing at that point.
Yeah.
By the end, it's not. But it also
helps us to observe better because we're a little off balance.
Oh, yeah. So, I was paying a lot of attention.
Yeah. Like. Yeah. Well, that's good because, I mean, I can also imagine a reader throwing the book across the room and saying, you know, I'm off balance. This book doesn't do that. There's something where we're off balance, but we're still invited in.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems to be important. There's also a nice kind of self-consciousness throughout where you have the narrator talking about how, you know, after Solzhenitsyn, what is there for the dissident writer to do?
Yes.
And I think there's this, right? I mean, and it reminds me a little bit of Kundera, The Unbearable Lightness of Being,
mm-hmm.
but not too much. I mean, like a little, but I think that there are, there are questions about like, what is there for the dissident writer or the expatriate writer or the person who has experienced this, what else is there to say about it? And here we have like these encounters pared down as so much Eastern European poetry is
mm-hmm.
Pared down and given to us in these little discrete chunks. So where do you want to go from here? It sounds like this is a good opening. In the second chapter, we have a little bit more story, I would say, more sort of story elements as we have our young narrator having an experience. And you have, it feels like the first one is more philosophical. The second one feels more narrative in ways. I especially enjoyed, this is called She Set Me Free from Symbols. I especially enjoyed the symbol of the grandstand itself, mm-hmm. right? And we can talk a little bit about that. There is a situation where there are official ceremonies that take place on the grandstand. The orphans in the orphanage, so our narrator is an orphan in the orphanage. The orphans are invited out to participate in a mild way in the ceremony and to show a kind of reverence to the state. And you have the apparatchiks in the grandstand. And you have the various responses, and then stuff happens, right? So you get this sort of beginning kind of setup, and then the narrator has an experience with the dismantled grandstand later. Do you want to talk more about the story itself, or
sure,
sort of set it up?
Sure, yeah. So So one thing I think is cool about, to kind of piggyback off of what you were talking about with like the politics of it, what I think is cool is like, and even like, what is the dissident writer to do? What you find is, he kind of gives the answer of what like a person who, like, interestingly enough, how everyone should approach their life, no matter what situation they find themselves in. Mm-hmm. And it's through these like brief loves that you actually see, like, no matter what your situation is, there is a way, and this is, I think, where he's like reaching, and he doesn't have kind of the full picture to actually see how to do it, but he knows what like the life is supposed to be, but he doesn't know how to fill it out.
Yeah,
if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But so.
And so in the story, the grandstand is dismantled. The orphans end up going back at night, and so they see the grandstand being dismantled, and then later they encounter the dismantled grandstand, mm-hmm. and they play on it a little bit. Our narrator gets lost. He gets sort of tangled up, and then he encounters a person. Right. So there's, I mean, so you have what you just laid out, and that seems to be the pattern of the stories. It's too loose and varied to call it a formula for the stories, but it does seem to be a pattern that we see throughout. And so we have the narrator have this, this experience. Do you want to talk a little bit about the woman encountered and anything else in the story that stands out to you?
Yes. Yeah, sure. We can talk more. So I think it's cool because he's trapped and he's afraid and then he gets angry and he can't escape the grandstand, which mm-hmm. is a symbol.
Right. Right.
And it's a symbol of, you know, communism and all this stuff. And it's like, well, how do I get out? How do I escape? And then he gets to the top of it. So he actually climbs out and he gets to the top, but he's still not kind of, I would say, out of the grandstand. Because now he's kind of like on the grandstand. And it's when he sees a woman. And he says, in seeing this woman, he was aware that this occurrence, this is on page 26, this occurrence did not belong to the world I lived in. It's like the world of the grandstand, the world of the orphanage. And it's interesting because he sees a woman in a pretty ordinary thing. She's sitting, I believe, on the grandstand. She's sitting down. Yeah, she's sitting on the grandstand with closed eyelids, bathed in sunlight, and on her knees she held an open book. And he's just fixated mm-hmm. by her.
And we get the juxtaposition of her sitting mm-hmm. there in a she's referred to the, as I reached the lowest tier, I saw such a violently grief-stricken shadow pass across her gaze, and I turned away and fled behind the grandstand. There the mystery of the trap was resolved. And so we understand what the resolution is and like how to get out of the grandstand. And so there's this juxtaposition with the woman and her authentic emotion, her authentic experience, and how the trap can be resolved. And then the solution to the trap turns out to be quite simple.
Yeah. Like the door was there the whole time.
Right. I mean, it's like the purloined letter. It's like, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like every story where, you know, it's there the whole time. You just have to see it.
Yeah. Well, and he's also in a strange situation in that he went into the grandstand with some of the other orphans who have left him there.
Right.
They've abandoned mm-hmm. him. They do know how the door opens.
Mm.
And they've left him in his sphere. And he does realize later that he's been gone about 5 minutes.
Right.
That his perception of it is so overwhelming because it's so terrifying. And that they are just kind of laughing at him. But it's only being so terrified that she is so illuminating.
Right.
So there's so much darkness.
There's the extremity of her emotion, but there's the extremity of his emotion.
Yes. Mm. They're kind of meeting in this very crossed way of his fear in the darkness and her sorrow in the snow.
Yeah. Yeah. At the end of the story, there's I realized this was a very fleeting moment and yet a vital one in the life of a tortured being. All the pain is still there, but love is already breaking free from it and is alive briefly in its absolute truth. The world, with its absurdities, its lies, and its and all its ugliness, no longer comes between the woman and the one she loves.
There is, though, in that, the theme that does keep coming up, that is true because he is dead. Her lover is dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it often happens that these moments the narrator experiences or remembers follow very quickly with the death of the person that mm-hmm. he's experienced mm-hmm. them with or their disappearance.
Right.
As we'll talk about later, because people just kept disappearing.
yeah.
So there, it's never, you're never really far away from the threat that this all exists because someone has died or is about to.
Right. Right.
So.
Right. So you think about the person later in the novel who is, you know, horribly burned.
Mm-hmm.
You think about there are a variety of different deaths and disfigurements that speak to this. Right.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that is a really simple but obvious place where he hasn't a great understand. Sorry, our author has a great understanding and yet falls short.
Mm.
Because the, you know, the Christian revelation mm-hmm. is that death is not the end. Our life is not beautiful because we die. It's beautiful because we rise again.
Mm-hmm.
And all the things that we do that are beautiful are participating in that.
Right.
So it, I think it is clear that he, like, McKean can't quite escape death yet.
Yeah.
Just that sort of it leaves us in a place of abstraction, right? So the loves mm-hmm. live forever, but there's not a real shape to that.
They're not
going
to.
Right.
They're going to live it forever as long as your memory is alive. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And he does mention that, like, how, like, his view is, like, because, he, you know, an eternally living doctrine, the fourth chapter starts, "The fatal mistake we make is looking for a paradise that endures," page 53. And so, like, that, yeah, so we know that there is a paradise that endures, and it's these moments that he's referring to where love breaks through sorrow, love breaks mm-hmm. through suffering, because he talks about, like, he says some really powerful things, you know, going back to chapter 2, the last lines, like, there's this woman he's never talked to, he's only kind of had this experience where their eyes meet, and he says, "At the end of the street, I can still make out the young woman in black who has just walked away, an intense feeling of communion. Then her silhouette fades into the impetuous minstrel's blue and gold."
Mm-hmm.
So, like, he's getting that there are these moments mm-hmm. of real communion with real people that open up, you know, reality. Because earlier he says, in the same chapter, on page 27, "Thanks to her, I suddenly knew what it was to be in love. To forget your past life and exist only to sense the breathing of the one you love, the quiver of her eyelashes, the softness of her neck beneath a gray scarf, but above all, to experience how blissfully impossible it was to reduce this woman simply to herself."
Hmm.
So it's like these, like, which I think is really powerful, because it's in seeing the immense goodness of this person that he's able to see the immense goodness of all reality. And then he's just like, "But there's no paradise that endures." And it's like, "Oh, buddy."
I took that in chapter 4, though. Sorry, I'm going to just, like, skip ahead here.
Yeah.
I took that, "The fatal mistake we make is to look for a paradise that endures," to be just in the next paragraph, not to take myself for a statue.
Yeah.
So,
you're going to have to explain that.
Well, I don't know if I can.
Well, just provide enough context so that our listeners can follow without having a book in front of them.
Oh, wait. I have to provide the context?
I mean, to some degree, too, it's a paradise. The fatal mistake we make is looking for a paradise that endures is also, like, the temporal utopian reach, right?
Yes.
And so there's that. I mean, so the idea that we can do something that that lasts in that way is something that people fall into over and over again.
Yeah.
Yes.
Have I bought you enough time to...
Yes. Well, and the chronological thrust of the book is watching a young man who's grown up in an orphanage run by the state and indoctrinated from birth with the utopianism of what turned out to be very late and decrepit Soviet state, and him growing out of that utopianism, but not into anything else.
Mm-hmm.
Not even into cynicism, just into, I'm not sure. Because he's not dead at the end of the book. Who knows?
Well, I mean, there is that. There's room for the poet, right? There's room for watching the snow fall. There's room for, again, in the second to the last chapter, for wanting to be in that apple orchard, there are those things that, that again, I'm not sure I would say transcend, but they cut through.
They do. And he goes from imagining himself with others who are not humans, because the way he describes them, of this, the perfect man and the perfect woman who know no fear and no jealousy and have no envy, those are not real. I think he becomes very embodied in the real.
Hmm.
And I think that that is a very good thing.
Yeah.
So.
And it's hard for him.
Yes, yeah. and it is. And so when I hear him say, like, the fatal mistake we make is looking for a paradise that endures, I take that to meaning as himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like a human person that endures and is not changed.
Okay. Mm.
And that he is, at this point in chapter 4, learning that it is only a statue that does not change. And right. I, as a man, cannot be a statue.
Right, so it's a little ode on a Grecian urn.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit of, is it better to, you know, to live forever as the work of art, or is it better to be real? And so here,
yes.
It's the fatal mistake is looking for.
Well, and in his case, not living forever as the work of art, but living forever as the work of politics.
Right.
Living forever as the work of the state to mm-hmm. prove that the state worked.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also saw that. Well, I saw that line as like there is something in us that wants an unending paradise.
Yes.
And without revelation, that looks like your 5-year plan, your 10-year plan, your like, you know, like your portfolio, your all the in our world, right?
In
communist Russia, it's, you know, the triumph of the state, but you know, and I think that's part of his brilliance is like you don't replace communism with consumerism,
right? Mm-hmm. Like, that it's discussed yeah. overtly in a way yeah. that I think is really helpful. Yeah. I mean, the idea that like what are you looking for? You think you'll be free if you get to engage in self-expression,
yeah.
Through. You know, through consumer goods or through yeah. You know, other kind of material.
Driving your convertible.
Yes.
I like
on
that
Sunset
that was
Boulevard.
The image that they kept talking to
yeah.
each other
yeah.
about. I
right.
was like, what yeah. movie did you guys see this in?
So like that's kind of yeah. how I took it is like, no, like live for these moments
mm-hmm.
where he doesn't use this language, but where the infinite breaks through the finite, where you
right.
are able to transcend and experience.
Right.
That's so funny because I took it. I took it for him to mean live more as a human body, like
yeah.
not that far, like to come back inside
mm.
yourself. Uh-huh. And this is kind of like chapter 4 is where he starts to kind of like just you know how I'm trying to say this in like the most family friendly way, just. Enjoy and find the limitations of just general casual pleasure mm-hmm. and like so he's
yeah
I don't know, I took that so much more to be like to be real in the world
mm.
that you live in
yeah
with the like actual physical experiences you have.
Yeah, I think mm-hmm. there are like, different moments where you get both of those
yeah.
things. I mean, not to be Marilyn Vos Savant. You're both
yeah.
right.
Well, no, I was going to say,
I think that,
yeah.
Yeah, but I think yeah. that the, I mean, and you also get in, you know, secular writers like Virginia Woolf, this idea of moments of being, right?
Mm-hmm.
These moments that in the time, the way that our lives move in time, you
mm-hmm.
get these moments that are actually sort of like lived lyric moments, moments that open out. And have a kind of luminosity, have a kind of reaching beyond themselves. And I think like also the sudden realizations made me think of like the epiphany stories of James
mm-hmm.
Joyce. Again, same kind of idea where you have access to those things in a way that's really earthbound,
mm-hmm.
That's sort of, that's different from where... somebody like Eric Varden might go, or somebody
yeah.
where that, you know, Eric Varden might push us, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have that. And then there are other moments where it does seem to be about what physical pleasure does to remove one from, you know, the ideological situation.
Mm-hmm.
But more than that, as you said.
Well, I mean, I think that the narrator... takes that, I have to be very clear with myself about that. I think the narrator takes that as the first step. I don't think it's his last step. I think
mm-hmm.
he does get, as he grows older, as he reflects more on the people he has known and what he has experienced with them, I think he does get farther
mm-hmm.
towards seeing that as these moments break through, they are showing something more.
Yeah. Well, I think what's interesting is when he has these, because he does talk about pursuing physical pleasure, but that's never what strikes him. It's almost like
oh no, you know, he's very clear that it's like banal and boring.
Yeah. Right, ultimately. Like not at first, but later.
Yeah. Yeah, but like after like 2 weeks. Yeah. I mean, that vacation he's on is not that long.
Yeah. But I think that's kind of cool that he has these, because it's one of the things where he's setting you up and you're just like, okay, we get it. But then all of a sudden he just throws this complete curveball.
Yes.
And he exposes how, because it's right, it's very, it's lived in the body. You know, the experience of, I would say, like, contemplation is very human. It's very incarnational. But it's in a way that's, like, transcendent and imminent.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Whereas, like, when he's just pursuing the base pleasures, it's almost eluding him. And he starts actually talking about himself. Like, all of, like, the real relationships, there's this beautiful chastity to them. And then when he's engaged in this love affair on this 2-week vacation, he actually talks about how mechanical they were.
Mm-hmm.
And then he... can we talk about that chapter? You guys want to talk about it?
Sure.
Yes.
Should we just skip to...
we can just skip to it. I have to say, I definitely wonder, and maybe I'll write him a letter or, you know... whatever, email. I wonder, in living in France, how much that has influenced how he is remembering his own experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Because both the narrator and the author live in France and as adults. And I think that's Lovers on a Stormy Night, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that chapter in particular is a really stunning rebuke to Michael Houellebecq, the famous French author, whose cynicism and secularism is continually reinforcing the point that sex is the only pleasure available in life, and it is diminishing, so enjoy it while it's fun. And that is such a prevalent voice in French literature that this seems like very pointedly speaking back to that.
That's helpful. Thinking about like how the text seems conscious of like Solzhenitsyn, the text seems conscious of like the contemporary French as well. So so that's that's super helpful.
That was very much what I was like, who are you reading? Because I've read that guy too.
So, David wanted to go to Lovers on a Stormy Night.
I don't want to ruin the whole book for everyone because I want them to read it. I shouldn't just drop all of my favorite quotes.
The point of the book is that even if you know all the words, it's still going to be beautiful.
Right.
That's the moment of your experience.
And this is not a book that you read for plot. So it's not like, oh, Willoughby, what do you know?
If you can't figure out what happens to Willoughby,
come to English 10. I think that like this is the pacing and what's prominent in the different aspects of the story draw attention away from plot.
Yeah.
So I didn't feel bad about walking all the way through the second chapter.
Right.
So I don't feel bad about our images here with the narrator and Leonora and Brezhnev and Brezhnev and the role of Dr. T.J. Eckelberg. There's a billboard with Brezhnev on it.
Okay, so
on vacation in the Black Sea, our narrator meets a young lady.
And they go through the difficulties of engaging in hookup culture in Soviet Russia.
In Soviet Russia, where you cannot rent a hotel room because there aren't any hotel rooms. And even if you could, you're not married.
Right. Well, and there's this whole thing about identification, right?
Yeah.
So they see a film where everyone in the audience is very excited because the man walked into a hotel and without presenting any kind of identification was given a room key, and everyone's astonished.
Yeah.
So yes.
And so the chapter right before that, our narrator is talking with this girl that has, you know, he talks about being in love with her. And he's talking with her about, you know, the glorious, eternal city of communism where no one needs anything, no one wants anything, and everybody's happy. And she actually throws him for a loop by basically just saying, aren't you happy now? And he wants a political argument. He does not want her to say, why can't everyone be like us?
Right.
We are happy in this moment. And she says, the one thing necessary, love one another.
Yeah.
Basically.
And I mean, and in every situation, what's to stop them from being happy now? Not hating other people, not being greedy, like you said, not punching other people in the face at any rate, which is a reference to something that just happened. But I don't think they know a true path yet. They need to be shown. They need a plan, a theory, a doctrine. And she says, a doctrine? What for? We're happy here.
Which kind of makes me wonder if, I mean, I'm sure he has read Dostoevsky, but it reminds me of The Grand Inquisitor, where Christ is, you know, like Christ himself is the standard, the judge, the rule, the measure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you get to get in or out of Russia without, you know, a little smattering of Dostoevsky over there.
Well, they do something right. So but
now, short of his, like, political passions and seeing that they may be fleeting.
He says, our affair led to nothing beyond sun-soaked cliches. In short, it did not lead to love. I'm on page 73. And then above that, he says, because, like, you have to find, you got to get creative and find new places and hide and all this stuff. And he says, we hobbled after one of their adventures. We hobbled blindly along in the darkness, groaning and limping, exiled from a paradise we believed in less and less. And so you just have this clear lack in their relationship. And then that's when they eventually make their way to the movie theater where we have this great scene where, you know, like what he says, was it Patrick Deneen? No, Patrick DeWare did more for the collapse of communism.
Paging Dr. Freud. That's funny. But yes.
More effectively than all the dissidents put together, Patrick DeWare contributed to the fall of the Berlin Wall because he rented a hotel without identification. Now on page
there's 80. A big storm.
There's a big storm, and it's when they're leaving, and it's raining everywhere, and the train is delayed. Makes perfect sense. And so they find their way underneath this giant billboard of Brezhnev.
And not at all symbolic.
Well, doesn't it on the other side say, like, the future's coming, be prepared, or something like that? It's also on the other, there's something on the other side.
Well, there's the
USSR is the bulwark of peace, democracy, and friendship between peoples.
Right, and that's the side that has Brezhnev with someone has thrown the fruit on his face. Yeah. Right, so you have the fruit stains on his face. And then you have the slogans. Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
And then instead of a passionate embrace, there was this unmoving caress of a hand upon a shoulder. So you just have like this very clear, mechanical lack of love. And then all of a sudden, this old couple comes in. And this line.
And it's dark. So the old couple, they don't see each other.
Yeah, the old couple doesn't see them. And they start hearing them talk. And it's an old man talking to this older woman. And the narrator, thank you, Andrea, says on page 81, the more they spoke, the more the distance separating them from us increased. Here were two survivors of Tsarist Russia, two white Russians, as they used to be called, two people who refused to flee the country they knew, even though it had completely changed. And the years go by, and he goes off to war to fight for a country he does not love and does not know during the Great War, World War II. He comes back. What do they call it in Russia? The Great Patriotic War, I think, is what they call it. The years go by, and still they have the sense that this beautiful clarity of their young days is miraculously preserved within them. So they have these brief encounters, and like they just pick up, nothing left off. And then this is one of my favorite lines. For the 60th anniversary of their marriage, they travel to the Black Sea, first a week in the Crimea, then a brief stay on the coast near the Caucasus. On the evening of their departure, a storm breaks. Now we're like caught up to the present.
Yeah.
They escape from the general melee at the station and find themselves sheltering beneath an enormous propaganda billboard. So remote from the world, so present in their own world, which they have never really left.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, like for them, the love that unites them has like kept them, I would say, you know, in paradise, even amidst this complete upheaval. Right. And he said, when they finally, they make it back to the train station, and then as the couple approaches, now we noticed how different they were from the rest. An ordinary couple of their age would have rushed towards the steps up to the coach with an air of panic, pushing us aside, perhaps anxious that the train was about to depart, concerned to secure their seats. The old man and his companion at once appreciated that before them stood two young lovers on the brink of parting. They stopped and even drew back a little, remarking quietly that the storm was moving southward. Instead of any conventional outpourings, my friend bowed her head slightly and my lips brushed her brow. This unintentionally chaste kiss seemed to us the most beautiful of all those we had exchanged that summer. It's almost just like flipping the tables on that French guy.
He completely is. Like, the more I thought about it, like, as today went on, I was like, wow, he's really almost angry at how cynical others are, like, treating life.
Yeah. But then, and then, like, he fast forwards, and he's in this wax museum, and you can, like, torture the Brezhnev guy, basically. Right.
I don't know how I ended up feeling sorry for Brezhnev at that moment, but I really did. Like,
yeah.
Because that's, I mean, the idea that any human's life ends up as a circus act for others to fake torture, I was like, that is unbearably depressing, even if you're a terrible person.
Right. But that's what I love when he, like, this is what I think he's, like, so close, you know? Like, he's he's seeing, and he has, like, he has something valuable to teach all of us who, like, know it all, right, up here in our minds, you know? Like, he says, who might hold the old man in his rocking chair in more contempt than these two survivors of the Russia long ago? Who more than they had a right to redress on the part of history? And yet I was absolutely certain that they would never have grasped the avenging handle.
Yeah. For there was no hatred in their hearts. Just the glow from those moments of past time the man talked about so as to restore his companion's composure during the stormy night. You have that, you know, the idea that they're so free of hatred for these outside forces, right? Yeah.
And it's like it can't shake them, you know, like...
Mm-hmm.
Because they have experienced, like, actual love.
Mm-hmm.
And it's able to reflect how they act towards everyone around them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's funny because it's, like, so remote in their world, so distant from ours. And yet when they do encounter the couple, like, they actually respond with love. And that actually enables the couple to actually kind of love each other for the first time in that moment. It's
what saves it from sentimentality, though, is that, I mean, so there's some elements of it that are kind of, like, obvious or predictable, but then, I mean, sort of like the Brezhnev billboard and, you know, I mean, the sort of like, I mean, those kinds of elements. And also some of the language is really overt. Like, the emotional language is really overt. Mm-hmm. Like, this is how the characters feel.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, rather than here's what they do that leads you to a place where you can infer what they feel, right? It's that he tells you what they feel. And the thing that saves it, I think, from sentimentality is that complexity, right? Mm. That the situation itself always has a kind of complexity in it that sort of turns it over for you, that sort of brings you in, allows you to see it, and then turns it over. Also, the Eastern Europeans are more on the nose with the emotional language.
Hmm.
I don't know if you all reacted to the style in any way as a result of, you know, some of the language that again is very, very much telling you what the emotions are.
I experienced that as a reader much more in what you mentioned in the beginning and the fairy tale element. That is what helped me feel that presence in, like, our continual journey into the dark and into the forest, was that it's gonna, like, keep being named so that I am not lost.
Yeah, so these are the breadcrumbs.
Yes, exactly. And that I actually found very helpful. And it helped me feel an older style of writing, in a sense of, like, when you read, like, correspondence from, I'm thinking of, like, Turgenev and Flaubert's letters to each other.
Okay.
And, again, Russians and French. And, like, their language is very flowery in a way that somebody who grew up in 1990s Portland is very uncomfortable with. Or I'm like, no. We need some ironic distance. This is super upsetting.
Right. This is way too close to me.
Yes. So I actually, I was really helped by the very pointed, like, and now we feel this. I was like, great. I am not lost. And I'm only vaguely uncomfortable. I'm not totally uncomfortable.
Yeah. And I think too, like, I mean, because there is so much sort of reacting against the ideology, there is a kind of reaction also against, I mean, it's a reaction against cynicism. There's probably there's some irony, but there's a kind of also a reaction against kind of the ironic mode or the ironic stance. That, I mean, the journalists do that, right? They trash one side, they trash the other side.
Yes,
go ahead.
As we come to the end and we meet the journalist and feel that, I think, only, like, first point of, like, real, close to despair in his speaking with that man who does not remember how much he was loved, that, yes, that's kind of, like, the only part where you're like, oh, this could turn out badly if it turns one way or the other.
Well, I liked how in that chapter, to kind of point out, like, I guess, like, he is kind of, like, beating you over the head with this, but he does the callback to the woman who had seen Lenin, because he says, he expected this, like, gaunt, because this man who's now a journalist and plays both sides against each other, was this so-called tortured soul living among peasants and exiled for his dissidence, and he was a revolutionary and going to change the world, and so our narrator thinks he's going to be gaunt and, like, pale and basically, like, he just escaped prison, and he's, like, this very plump kind of, I guess, childish kind of character. He's basically just there to sell you some BS, and because he doesn't believe in anything.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And he has this, like, shallowness to it, to contrast with the woman who actually had seen Lenin, who, oh my gosh, I just love all these chapters. Who, like, actually is very poor, kind of exiled and all this stuff, but, like, gives of her poverty to take care of those who are less fortunate than her.
Yes.
And it's kind of funny because here's this woman was an ideologue, but valued human life.
Yes, who's made a great sacrifice because she understands the cynicism of the entire project.
Right.
I mean, I don't think that there's any apology in any of this for Marxism in any way.
Oh, no.
No.
There's a great love for country.
Yeah.
Right. And there's I think very old style understanding of, like, Russia as homeland.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. There's a lot of talk about the system was terrible, but it was also where my childhood took place.
Yeah. Yes.
And that there's something valuable about that, because it's also my life. And so there's this, so that connection seems to be humanizing and important. And again, sort of cutting through and doing something different from this way of looking at the political situation, or that way of looking at the political situation.
But like the woman who had seen Lenin, she also was, like, exiled by Lenin. So,
right.
And that's kind of one of the big starts in his realizing there's something wrong here. But her ability to love other people kind of motivates him. And after he has this experience of falling wildly in love with everything around him, because he sees the woman's granddaughter running towards her.
Right.
But then he's able to... so there's this character in the story who was a drunkard, who was, like, vulgar and tatted up and just, like, your stereotypical, you know, problematic person on the sidewalk, right? That we all kind of like,
you vagrant know, is the vagrant. Word you're looking
Thank
for.
You. Yeah, you know. And he looks at him and you can tell there's this lack of communion during the first batch. But after he sees this woman who's able to love, he says again, I saw the drunkard Sashka, this is on the bottom of page 48, sitting on the ground. He was much older than I had thought. Gray locks clung to his brow. He was singing, his eyes almost closed. His tattoos could not be seen, for he had put on a jacket with several medals from the last war pinned to its front. When the train came in, the people surged forward toward the track. Sashka was left alone. I threw him a farewell glance and suddenly saw that both his legs were amputated. A dusty cap was flung down in front of his stumps. A pair of crutches stood there leaning against the station wall. And then he sings the song he had already heard, but unlike before, he doesn't have the vulgar. And it's like he's actually able to see this vagrant as someone lovable because of what he's experienced.
Yeah.
Which, like, again, comes up, like, you know.
Yeah. So, I mean, we talked before about, like, the symbol of the grandstand. In that story, you've got some balloons, a red balloon and a blue balloon. You've got a variety of symbols. I mean, certainly that Brezhnev billboard. you have the, and I mean, for me, this apple orchard is just amazing. This is Captives in Eden, which starts on page 105, where you have, I mean, again, this idea of this walk in this beautiful, gigantic apple orchard in blossom. We're told that it's sterile, that it can't produce apples. And so there's a little, there's some business about the uselessness of beauty, which is probably interesting to Mr. Bowes. You want to talk about that?
I guess just a little bit. Yeah. I loved when he said, I felt tempted to speak up for the wonderful uselessness of beauty. It's also like the great kind of, like, again, you go back to like, this is my childhood and being able to see the beautiful. It's like, this is a Soviet propaganda machine. Mm-hmm. And yet, even though it's for all intents and purposes, sterile, useless, a dumb project.
Mm-hmm.
It nevertheless just like, captivating.
Right. And of course, the thing that really gets me about this symbol is that it, I mean, so again, the idea of looking back at this this apple orchard as, you know, as again, this kind of it's erected for show, and it's a it doesn't have a good purpose and it doesn't produce anything, but it's beautiful. There's in the center of it, there seems to be a fountain, and there's and so they bathe in the fountain, and there's all of this, and there's this idea too of this really flawed thing that one feels really attached to. Reminded me so much of the cherry orchard. So where you get so Chekhov, like where you get the this idea of you know, the nostalgia for Tsarist Russia, right? And here you have it. Things are changing. You know, what are we gonna do? And that the sort of the sadness of that famous play. That here you get, I mean, obviously it's an apple orchard. We're, you know, we understand. And the title does say the word Eden in it. So, I mean, clearly that's the primary referent. But also that idea of this kind of, sense of, the importance of the dignity of the value of what's come before, and sort of like what that is and then how it works. I think that's why that image is so especially vivid and meaningful for me. And then at the end, of course, you get, he gets to see it from a distance and, you know, and more, and there's more of a, there's another final view of it at the end of the chapter. I don't know, anything else that you want to say about that?
I really liked that chapter. A lot. I think it tied so many of the pieces together because he's there reunited with a woman that he'd been in the orphanage with who has been referenced so in almost every story, I think, as Little Red Riding Hood because she was determined to be an individual and wear a red cap instead of the gray. And he sees her in this place where she should be the most individual, because they're far away from being sighted. It is private, even though it's vast. She should be the most herself.
Right.
And he sees that she has become completely subsumed in not even idealistic politics, but in cynical politics.
Yeah.
And that she's wasting her heart on a man who clearly doesn't love her. And it turns out doesn't even know her name. That was super sad.
That was.
I think, like, I really liked this chapter in the way it pulled all of the little pieces together. And then you go to the last chapter where he's, like, his most fully adult that we meet him.
Right.
Because this is, like, he leaves something in that orchard, and we're not quite sure what. But somebody different walks out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there is a fountain in the middle of the orchard.
Yes. I mean, they take a bath. Yeah. There's, like, a whole thing.
It's, like, the whole, it's, like, every, it's, like, every possible archetypal symbol. Yes. Yes.
I mean, as long as there, if they'd had a wooden horse, I would have totally bought it. Of, like, of course there's a wooden horse there. Like,
do you teach this one, David? If not,
I do not.
I would
think
like
you
it.
Should.
Yeah, I would like it because I think that that it ties in really well with a lot of stuff that we do about the way that symbols operate and sort of this idea of lateral thinking, encouraging us to think associationally about ideas. But that is off topic. So is there anything,
is that not the topic?
Though? Well, I mean, well, I don't know.
Sounds like you guys are saying I should just teach the whole book. I already do 5 of the chapters.
Do you?
You do 5 out of 8 chapters? Yeah, yeah. You should just read the teach the whole book, David.
Well, can I come
your
in for,
eight
for chapter
long.
7? All right.
You can leave this in.
That's fine.
So, do we leave it there? Is there anything else that we want to say? I think we should say some final things about how we've enjoyed this book and sort of in general what we draw from it.
I think it is a fantastic summer read for people. Highly recommend it as a summer read. Just, you know, summer, we start slowing down. We start wondering how we're going to fill our time. And I think McKean calls us back to remember that we are made for contemplation.
Yeah, sorry.
We're made to... Oh.
I would totally disagree. Like, this is a wonderful winter read. Yeah. Like, nice and cozy in your home when people are not bothering you or trying to get you to go to the beach. Like,
No, but I agree with what I think is behind the appeal, which is the sort of contemplative nature of the sort of the kind of, almost kind of the lyric nature of the stories as we go, and the way they're crafted in order to draw attention to these elements that are so valuable that are beyond certainly beyond politics, but beyond other mundanities that we get stuck in.
Yeah.
I'd agree.
Yeah.
I think that is a very good summing up of not just like why one would read this book, but maybe what to expect when reading this book. Because if you're looking for, you know, a really linear plot that like tells you stuff, that is not what you're going to get.
Right. Right. Thank you for listening to the Life of the Mind podcast from Brookwood and Avalon Schools. I'm Sherry Walsh here in the Andrea McKean Brief Loves That Live Forever episode with David Bose and Andrea Francois. Our producer is Quentin Walsh. Our theme music is by Fabian Tell.